it's a pleasure to be giving this talk. And so I actually took this title based on some lectures that Joe Pochinski gave in 1994. So Joe in 1994 was asking, what is string theory? I noticed he's still asking that a few months ago. And the reason, I guess people were asking this question for a long time, but in the mid and early 1990s, it became apparent that there probably wasn't a unique answer to this question, but there might be many definitions of string theory that were mysteriously related to each other through these so-called dualities. And so if today we sort of accept this idea, you know, that there's not a unique formulation of string theory, what's more interesting is to ask if we can use these, well, not more interesting, another interesting question is if we can use these different formulations to actually use string theory for new purposes. So that's why we're just going to insert the four. The four here. So we want to take advantage of the ambiguity of the definition of string theory to try to apply string theory to different fields such as condensed matter physics. And so the first thing I want to do, and this talk is definitely not for the string theorists, is I want to just give a simple sort of intuitive picture of what we mean by duality and where these duality ideas come from. And for that I want to go back to the 1970s. And as David just mentioned, in the 1970s, people were trying to use string theory to describe mesons, okay, in particle physics. Okay, now our modern picture of a meson, such as a pion or a kaon, is that it's a quark and an antiquark bound together by a sort of flux tube of gluons, okay, and these have some angular momentum, so they're spinning around. Now, string theory began as an attempt to understand these objects, these pions. But in those days, when you just had the experiments, it wasn't clear that so in QCD, we believe that the quarks and the gluons are the fundamental objects, and that this flux tube is somehow a derived object that you build out of lots of gluons. But in the early days, that might not have been so clear. And so, in fact, string theory had the idea of taking the flux tube itself, the string, if you like, to be the fundamental object. Okay? So string theorists were studying, strings. Okay. Now, QCD seems to have won out in this particular description, although I think many believe that string theory may yet have the last laugh in this question. But so despite the fact that QCD seemed to indicate conclusively that, you know, these flux tubes were composite objects, some people carried on studying string theory anyway. And once you're studying strings, it's natural to forget about the endpoints and just look at closed loops of string. And then at some point it was realized that when you look at closed loops of string, these behave a lot like gravitons. In particular, they have spin, they're massless, and they have spin too. And this study of closed strings then led to the idea that string theory could be a theory of quantum gravity. Okay, and so it stayed for, you know, a couple of decades. And then in 1997, there was an important breakthrough, normally associated with another Sina, which made the following surprising statement. So there exist theories in which these kind of objects exist, and it turns out that you can use either the strings or the quarks and the gluons, and they're both equally good fundamental descriptions of the string. Okay, so there exist special theories, which are, let's call them cousins of QCD, of quantum chromodynamics, in which you can have your gluons, your quarks, and your gluons. And this is completely equivalent to forgetting about the quarks and the gluons and just thinking of the string as the basic objects. And so this is a bit like these Rubin vases, okay, so I'm going to, you know, attempt to draw. Right? So, you know, is it a vase or is it two faces? Okay. possibly neither. So this is like this thing. Is it quarks and gluons or is it string? Okay, which one comes first and which one do you derive from the other one? And so it turns out that there exist these special theories where you can actually do either and you get exactly the same answer. Okay, so if QCD had been one of these special theories, then the string theory would have been right from the beginning. Okay. So this idea goes under several names, but for reasons I'm about to explain, I'm going to call it holography. Okay. And now the two most famous examples that I just have to mention for completeness, although they're not going to be very important for this talk, but just so that everyone's heard the names. So these are, you see statements like the following. The type 2B string theory. On ADS5 times S5 is completely equivalent to n equals 4 super Young Mills on Minkowski space. And I'm only even writing that down, not because I'm going to explain what any of these words mean, but just to make the clear point that there are two, in principle, completely well-defined theories that look very different. One of them is a theory of strings, and the other one's a theory of quarks and gluons, and they're the same. At least that's the conjecture. And this n equals 4 super Young Mills is sort of QCD with extra decorations. Okay, now, while there are many known theories that form dual pairs like this, what's more interesting, if you want to sort of apply this to the real world, is to extract the sort of fundamental logical structure that goes into these dualities. And so they all of them.
The left side is well defined.
In principle. There's a lot of evidence that the left hand side is well defined.
What would that mean? Two theories we understand, which is there are Hilbert spaces, local operators. What does that mean?
So there's certain observables so that you would like to calculate in field theory that you can calculate using this machinery. Now, at the moment, we can't calculate all observables using the field theory. Sorry, we can't calculate all field theory observables using this machinery, but we can calculate a lot of them.
Okay, so my understanding, just checking this, is that you have certain prescriptions for doing calculations.
Right.
Which look like they have something to do with strain.
Right.
But there isn't the analog of the structure for a field theory that says,
no.
A mathematical structure which I can put down the Hilbert space and all of that.
Right?
No. So it's not.
It's in principle well defined.
There is an analog, though. What is that? Well, constructing Hilbert space consisting of box spaces.
But, I mean, this is all related to the question, what is string theory, right? So,
is that a complete formulation of the left?
It's as good as fine diagrams.
But really, can we just, because I think the philosophy of this talk is that we can bracket this question and still do stuff. Okay, so that's why the four is important. It's not obvious. I mean, it's not an obvious thing, but it's true.
Well, I was encrypting the four as a number four.
Okay. All right, so there are these dualities, and now the surprising thing that I think almost nobody, except maybe Polyakov, anticipated, is that these strings that are completely equivalent to the quarks and gluons don't live in the same number of dimensions as the quarks and gluons, okay, which is a very counterintuitive thing. And so the way these dualities work is that there's a quantum field theory. So this is the logical, so I'm telling you they're complete, you know, more or less well understood examples, but then there's a logical structure that we just want to abstract from the specific examples. Okay. So typically you have a quantum field theory, and this quantum field theory is always strongly interacting in the cases where we can use this duality. And what strongly interacting means is that even though this quantum field theory has some description in terms of particles, these particles mix with each other so strongly, the elementary degrees of freedom are not useful. So the usual techniques of quantum field theory are, in general, not very useful. In particular, we can't calculate very much. Okay. And then on the other side, we have the string theory, which is, so I should say, strongly interacting and quantum mechanical. So string theory, in some limit of this correspondence, is going to be a classical theory of gravity. So let's say this quantum field theory is indeed in d space-time dimensions, and this quantum field of gravity is in at least d plus 1 space-time dimensions. Okay, so how does this work? So the picture you like to draw, so this is the idea of holography, okay? That the string theory provides, sorry, the quantum field theory provides a holographic description of string theory, that it encodes all the information in one lower dimension. So here you'd have your quantum field theory, and then there's some extra dimension in which the string theory lives. And in particular, in this limit, it's general relativity. Okay, so here there are closed strings, and here there are quarks and gluons. Okay, and so we often call this the bulk, and this we call the boundary. So what is this extra? Who ordered this extra dimension? And I'll tell you, the person who ordered this extra dimension was Wilson, a good condensed matter theorist, okay? I suppose. And what this extra dimension is the geometrization of the energy scale of the quantum field theory. Okay, so Wilson taught us that quantum field theory should be organized by energy scales, and that there are certain equations, the renormalization group equations, that tell you how to evolve quantum field theory from one energy scale to the next energy scale, and they're local. So the way this works out is that the equations of motion of general relativity, in let's call this direction R, in this radial direction, are precisely the renormalization group equations in the boundary field theory. Okay, so what gravity is doing in this case is completely geometrizing the energy scale of quantum field theory, and this gives us a very powerful way of thinking about quantum field theories. Okay, and so in particular,
what's the meaning of ADS?
Did I mention ADS? I haven't mentioned ADS. So let me. I'm getting there. So we have this extra direction, okay, and I'm telling you that this direction is associated with the energy scale. So all we really need is to know what bit's high energy and what bit's low energy. So I'm going to tell you that the bit that's furthest away from the boundary is the low energy infrared, and the bit near the boundary is the high energy in the ultraviolet. Okay, and so somehow what this extra direction is, space-time, is going to do is going to separate out geometrically the low energy and the high energy physics of the quantum field theory. And in fact, roughly, the energy, okay, I should say, I do need one scale. So as you see, I haven't drawn this extra direction flat, it's bent. And indeed, it's important that there's a curvature in this space. So there's some scale L, let's call it the ADS radius. It's a generic curvature scale of this manifold, and so the energy. So because if we want to convert units of length into units of energy, we need at least another unit of length so that we can invert it. So this energy is the radius divided by this curvature of the boundary.
Can you identify that with lambda QCD or something like that?
No. Let me get to that. So okay, I can mention it now. As John mentioned in his lectures a couple of weeks ago, so in this case, if this thing goes on forever, it means that there's no gap and it's going to be scale invariant all the way. If there's a dynamically generated scale like in QCD, what happens is that this metric is going to cap off at some point, and that's your mass gap. There are going to be no excitations at lower energies, and the scale at which that happens will be lambda QCD. Okay. Good. And so let me give you just a sort of a brief intuition of how this might make sense, okay, that this is low energy and this is high energy. So suppose we want to calculate some correlator in the field. So a basic object you like to calculate in almost all systems is some two-point function. So just some correlator between 2 points here and here. Okay, so how would we calculate that using this gravity dual? So roughly what you do, so this has some separation delta x. Okay, so what you do is you start here and you send the particle shooting into the bulk. That particle bends around and it comes back again. Okay? And this classical trajectory basically the on-shell action of this classical trajectory will calculate for you this two-point function, at least, you know, morally speaking. And now the interesting thing is that the more you separate the points, the more this trajectory goes into the bulk before it comes back out again. Okay? Now, and this is what we expect because we know that large distances correspond to low energies. Okay? So the larger the distance you take, the more into the infrared this trajectory will probe, and so you'll be sensitive, for example, to whether the theory has a mass gap or not. Okay? So if the theory has a mass gap, this geometry ends. So a little particle that just goes like this and comes back again will know if the theory has a mass gap or if it's scale invariant. But if we take two well-separated points, then we can start probing the low-energy physics of the field theory. Okay, so this is one way that we can think of this energy, this extra radial direction as being an energy scale. Okay, great. So suppose we believe that these methods provide us with some strongly coupled field theories where we can calculate stuff. So the next question is, what do you want to calculate? So for certain mathematically inclined string theorists, the natural answer to the question, what do you want to calculate, is something like, what is the spectrum of BPS operators as a function of the moduli of the supersymmetric field theory? And then they'll give you a very nice answer in terms of wall crossing formulae and hypergeometric metrics and so on and so forth. As David said, there have been very fruitful interactions with mathematics with these kind of questions. However, what has happened only recently is that people have realized that despite having these very exotic theories, you can ask very mundane questions. Okay? So we have these interesting theories, so we could ask, for example, you know, what is the frequency-dependent conductivity? Do these theories become superconducting? Do they have a Fermi surface? And I think that's really the shift of recent years, is this idea that you can use fancy stuff for really very, I mean, come on, people have been applying string theory to nuclear physics recently, and that's certainly, you know, much more lowbrow than anything any string theorist would have wanted to get involved with. And so this idea that mundane questions are also interesting and can be tackled with exotic, you know, exotic theories is an important conceptual shift. Which is not to say that the mathematical stuff is not interesting. This is big. Okay. All right. So I suspect many people might have thought about applying string theory to real world phenomena for a long time, but I think a paper or a series of papers that really made it clear was in 2001. When Policastro, Son, and Staronets calculated the viscosity of some of these strongly interacting field theories. And I think without that series of papers, we wouldn't be having this workshop now. Okay, so, but you're still going to ask why. So we have these exotic theories, and we can actually calculate things like viscosity or frequency-dependent conductivities, but why is that actually an interesting thing to do? So I think it's important then that there exist real world problems that involve strongly interacting quantum field theories that we often don't know how to solve any other way. And so this includes, for example, QCD at finite temperature just above the deconfinement transition. And that's been a very fruitful topic, but I'm not going to talk about it today just because this workshop is about condensed matter physics. So I want to now talk a little bit about the low energy physics of, let's call them non-Fermi liquids. Or just in general, often in condensed matter physics, we have the low energy theory is described by some strongly interacting many body problem. So, okay, let me give some examples, I guess. I mean, most famously, we have the cuprates, also heavy fermions, optical lattices, perhaps. Now, you might say, okay, so we have some complicated many body problem. Why don't we just put it on a computer? Okay, I mean, that's a pretty mundane thing to do, and you can just put in your basic lattice model, whatever, and just solve it, right? So there are at least two reasons why that doesn't always work. So problems with computers. Firstly, that if you want to do something that involves real time, so how things change in time, that's very expensive. So real time dynamics, because you know you need to store all your data points and you need to store the time evolution of your data points. So real time dynamics is not impossible, but hard. And also, as I think Jan Zanin will tell us on Thursday, there's a fundamental conceptual problem with fermions at finite density. And this is called the sign problem, which at least makes fermions difficult to put on a lattice at finite density. Okay, so given that at the moment at least computers can't solve everything for us, it seems interesting to ask if we can shed any light on these kind of questions using these string theory techniques. Good, so condensed matter. Now, as far as I understand, traditional, by which I mean, you know, over 20 years ago by now, but traditional condensed matter is structured around two concepts that are from Landau. So one was the concept of a quasi-particle, and the other was the concept of an order parameter. So the idea was that in a metal, electrons are actually very strongly interacting, and so you might not have thought, but you know, in all the textbooks we see the independent electron approximation, and you just use single electrons that are floating in space, and that's only possible because somehow, magically, electrons retain their single particle character even when they're strongly interacting. Sometimes. So that's the notion of quasi-particle, that there are effective electron-like excitations in many metals. And the order parameter is the idea that different phases can be distinguished by whether a certain quantity is zero or not. Now, the important thing about order parameters is that they can also fluctuate. They don't have to be fixed at their mean value. And the fluctuations of the order parameter often give you another kind of quasi-particle in terms of which you can describe your theory. So this is like spin density waves, for example. Okay, now, again, as far as I understand, there seems to be a consensus now that this does not always work. And in fact, the situations in which it doesn't work are correlated with these situations in which you get this exotic infrared behavior of materials, such as in the cuprates on heavy fermion compounds. So if this picture doesn't work, and obviously many techniques have been already been developed for dealing with this situation. But once this is out of the window, you can ask, so what can matter do? So if matter is not always just described by weakly interacting electrons with some fluctuating order parameters, you might ask, well, what is the space of possibilities? Okay, what can we get stuff at a finite density of stuff to do? Sorry?
Intelligent life.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if the brain is a weak interacting system. So what can matter do? And so at this point, I need to have a clear caveat that, you know, what I'm about to tell you is what can string theory do when we think of it as matter, okay? And now at this point, this is still not going to be sharply connected to any particular experimental system. So I think what we should think of it at the moment is a sort of mind-opening question of what exotic stuff can we get in strongly coupled systems where we can actually compute stuff, okay? That's what this duality gives us. It gives us some very exotic, strongly interacting system where nonetheless we can do computations using this dual picture. So at this point, there are no, you know, claims about explaining anything, but we're trying to focus on this question. And I was very encouraged on Friday when in a condensed matter talk, they do this too, apparently. Right, so I think it's a legitimate scientific question. Okay. Right, okay, so very good. So what does string theory look like when we think of it as dense matter, okay? So, well, the first thing we need to do is put in the matter, okay? So at the moment, I told you that we have this picture, and that we have our quantum field theory, and we have general relativity here. But just like this, this is still empty. It's just the vacuum, okay? And so if we want an important difference between condensed matter physics and particle physics is that often there's a density of stuff, okay? And so it turns out that you do that, so I'd like to have, say, a charge density in my field theory. So it turns out this is actually very natural to do and has a quite an intriguing solution, which is that if you want to do that, if you want to have a charge density here, it turns out that what you need to have in the bulk is some electric flux going out to infinity. Okay, and basically the amount of electric flux going out, it manifests itself as the charge, but where's this flux going to come from? Okay, so we need to have some kind of object here that sources the flux, and it might not seem obvious, but in fact the simplest way of doing this is by having a black hole sitting here in the deep infrared. So we have an electrically charged black hole, and the electric charge of that black hole gives us the charge density of the field theory. Now, you know, you might have preferred to put, you know, a charged neutron star or something here. Okay, but it turns out that the black hole isn't really the most universal way of doing it, because you don't have to say anything about what it's made of. Okay, it's just pure geometry with a charge. Okay, so does this do what we expect it to do? So what we're doing, we can also have a finite temperature, and we have a charge density. And these are both dimensionful parameters. So on general Wilsonian grounds, you only expect the temperature and the charge to modify the low energy physics of the theory, but the high energy physics should be the same. And that's just what happens, okay? So the black hole modifies the infrared geometry, but does not modify the UV behavior, okay? So we're just placing the theory at a finite charge density and temperature. So what have I got? So what theory do I need to do this? So when I just had geometry, I could use general relativity, so Einstein's theory. But to have this charge, I also need to have a photon in the bulk. So these charged black holes are solutions of what's called Einstein-Maxwell theory, okay? General relativity with a photon. Okay, so this is going to be the setup. And now we want to ask simple questions of this setup. So, well, let's start with equilibrium properties, all right? So we want to ask, what's the free energy of this state of matter that we've created? And so string theory should give us a way of calculating that. And so, well, rather than the free energy, let me give you the specific heat. So it turns out that there's some well-defined methods that relativists have been developing since the 70s for calculating the specific heat of that system. And so you find out the specific heat at low temperatures is linear in the temperature, okay? Which you say, well, okay, that smells like fermions. That's not too bad. So you know, first step, you know, let's give that a tick. But the next step, you might ask, well, what about the entropy density? So it turns out that this black hole has a finite entropy at zero temperature. Now, I'm doing something a bit strange here. I'm bringing up a problem right at the beginning before giving you some list of things that work nicely. And the reason I'm doing that is that actually this shows you what this is. What I'm going to take away from this point in a second is that addressing why the entropy. So, okay, I built some state of matter, and it turns out this state of matter has a finite entropy at zero temperature. Okay, so it turns out that thinking about this actually shows you that we haven't really left fundamental physics behind, and that addressing this question potentially will take us back to some interesting questions in relativity, in general relativity, in quantum gravity, in fact, as well. Okay, let me say it this way. The resolution to this question is either something deep about quantum gravity or it's something deep about condensed matter physics. Okay, so it's a win-win. It's a kind of win-win situation.
If you place bets.
So what do I mean? Okay, so there are really three options. So there's some system that has a ground, so I should say ground state entropies are not unheard of in condensed matter systems. Okay, so there are really three options. So one is that we've got the wrong ground state. So in particular, there might be some instability, say. So there may be a superconducting instability. Which tells us that this configuration, which I more or less guessed, is actually not the right configuration. That's option one. Option two is that this is an artifact of the classical limit in the bulk. So by classical limit, I mean, so I've just solved the Einstein-Maxwell equations, but I haven't included any quantum effects in the bulk. And then option three is that it's correct.
It's not mutually exclusive.
These two are not mutually exclusive, I guess, no. Okay. And then this, if it's correct, then this leads you to some kind of, I don't know, maybe I should call it a critical spin ice or something. Which I think would be an interesting state of matter to have predicted using string theory. Okay. If you don't want to reach this conclusion, you have to find out one of these, okay? And that's not so easy.
Sean, can I ask you, cases, I'm not even sure I have a case exactly in mind, but a case where you might imagine in string theory where you believe this result was exact would be one involving some kind of supersymmetry that guarantees it was actually generous.
Right.
When you say ground state degeneracies are unheard of in condensed matter physics.
I said they're not unheard of.
They're not unheard of. Yeah. Oh, okay, sorry.
But I think they're not, the known cases are not in these sort of exotic, strongly interacting quantum critical systems.
If you're thinking there's a system in a continuum as opposed to a lattice or a particular number.
Even if you had some kind of supersymmetry in the ground state satisfying some.
No. But this is not supersymmetric.
From our perspective,
can you gain some insight if you reverse, you start on a quantum field theory side and work your way in?
Absolutely. No, that's right. So, I mean, David mentioned this connection between fields has to go in both directions, and absolutely, yeah, maybe.
I didn't just mean it in a social.
No.
When you come up with this problem, perhaps that's because you assumed a relatively simple gravitational background. Is there some way when you can start with some quantum field theory and work its way into see how gravity gets complicated in that case?
No, I think that's definitely a legitimate approach. That's right. And it's not totally connected to the idea that there might be some more complicated state in the gravity that it wants to go to. So let me just address these.
Very, very simple question. So the recent Northstone black hole in the ADS background is gravitationally stable stationary solution.
I'm getting there. Okay, so actually let me deal with this one first, because this would be the most exotic, if it's true. Because this black hole geometry I've given you is weakly curved everywhere. There are no large curvatures, and so there's no reason to expect general relativity not to be correct. And so we have come across before examples where there are problems with general relativity and entropy and weak curvatures, and it's called the black hole information paradox. Which is widely agreed to be one of the deepest and most confusing problems in, or maybe Joe solved it recently, I'm not sure. Black hole information paradox. Which is the following, that you get the wrong answer for the entropy, even though it looks like a classical calculation should be valid. Okay, that's the paradox. So if this is true, that somehow you have to get this entropy from being large to zero using what should be a small correction, that's a difficult thing to do, and if you can do it, it's something deep about quantum gravity, which would be great. Okay, now let me spend a little time talking about this option, because there's some interesting physics. So maybe we had the wrong ground state and there's just an instability. So instabilities in the field theory are really just instabilities in the bulk. So as Jan was saying, it's just a question of whether you have your rising knowledge, your black hole, and if you perturb it a little bit, maybe it wants to grow and go somewhere else. So it turns out there's actually a very natural instability that can happen towards superconductivity that can happen in these gravitating systems. And it's been known in general relativity for a long time, and it is called superradiance of black holes. Okay, and the way that works is very nice. So let's have our setup. That's our quantum field theory. This is the bulk. We have a black hole here. And this black hole had an electric field coming out of it. So it turns out that in the presence of an electric field, suppose I also have, which you often do, a charged scalar field in the bulk. Okay, so now as well as gravity and electromagnetism, suppose I also have some matter that's charged under this U1 in the bulk. So basically there's a classical analog of pair production for these waves in which you create a little wave of this. So okay, let's suppose the black hole is positively charged. It's kind of a convention. Then what you can do is you can pair create little ripples of this field such that a negative charge goes that way and a positively charged wave goes the other way. This is a bit of a cartoon, I should say, of what's happening. But so roughly the idea is that this black hole can discharge itself into this scalar field because these waves go in and these ones come out. And it's a cartoon. Okay. But it's I think it's morally sort of correct. And so the end point of this procedure is that all the charge is going to escape from the black hole and it's going to be sitting in this scalar field is going to be non-zero now. And all the charge will have come out and there's going to be some profile for the scalar field. You'll still have the electric field in infinity, but this electric field is not going to be carried by a black hole anymore, but by sort of these charges. And what this is dual to, the description in the field theory of this, is that there's some operator, a charged operator, that gets a non-zero vacuum expectation value, okay, which is, let's call this superconductivity. So the point I'm trying to make here is that within gravity, there's a very natural type of instability for these charged black holes that's been known for a very long time. And that if you follow this instability, you end up in quite a different state, which, although it's probably not completely known, has a good chance of having zero entropy.
I just don't understand what you just said. Why isn't it a good chance of having zero entropy? I mean, if it's
there's no horizon.
If it's a classical GR effect, so we know the entropy, the horizon area increases.
Yeah, it's can't go to zero. So it depends whether you're keeping the temperature or the mass. It's just a cartoon for what's happening. There's a phase diagram in which you have these solutions that connect onto this one.
Are you talking about thermodynamic instability as opposed to dynamical instability?
Well, you see it as a dynamical instability of this solution. But what you see is that if you were just cool it down below this state, you just wouldn't have this guy. You'd have this guy. It's still a second order transition. But maybe I don't want to go into it. This is a good enough picture for the what causes the instability of this ground state.
That's linearized.
Yeah.
So getting track of the ground state entropy by just looking at how the entropy is digested when it goes through the sexual differentiation.
So you can. Yeah, I mean, you can definitely calculate the free energy as a function of temperature.
Yeah. But as Don's when it goes to a non-negative ground state, in this other phase, then you would say that the ground state entropy manifests itself in the sort of evolution of the entropy.
So say it again.
The question is, how does the entropy, I mean, classically?
No, I know. Unless Gary wants to say something.
The 2 second answer is, you always evolve at fixed energy. And at fixed energy, we have an area theorem classically, and the entropy is not going to decrease.
Right.
But what's of interest here is the thermodynamic question of a fixed temperature. And at fixed temperature, the horizon can certainly be lower at one temperature than another.
But at fixed temperature, isn't minimizing the free energy, at zero temperature, isn't minimizing the free energy maximizing the entropy? And therefore, how can we say the permanently stable state has zero entropy if we have another state that has higher entropy?
It has higher energy.
But it's zero. But ground state.
U minus
there was zero temperature. Black hole has higher energy. And
I mean, you can just calculate the free energy for these heavy black holes.
They're both zero temperature states, but they're not the same.
Okay, so the question is, does this happen? So I'm telling you that there's a natural instability, but it depends on having this scale of some matter in the bulk. And furthermore, it only happens if this matter in the bulk, just schematically, so this matter, okay, this field phi is going to have a charge and a mass. And basically, this instability only happens if the charge is bigger than its mass in some appropriate sense. Okay, so this, if we want this sort of this instability to kick in, there has to be some matter in the bulk that has the property that it, in some appropriate units, its charge is bigger than its mass. Now, this is a very interesting thing because a few years ago there was a proposal by Arkani Hamid et al. Called gravity as the weakest force. And the statement of this proposal is basically that there should always exist at least one particle such that the electric force between them is bigger than the gravitational force between them. And that's what this says, okay, that its charge is bigger than its mass in some units. Now, they propose this, again, as a supposedly deep statement about quantum gravity. And I'm not really sure whether it's true or not. But that's what you need. Suppose you want all such black holes to always be unstable, okay, then it has to be true that in the string theory, the theory of gravity, there always exists a particle with its charge bigger than its mass. And if that's true, then you have this gravity as the weakest force conjecture would also be true. And this is not a trivial statement about quantum gravity. So the claim of this statement is that any consistent theory of quantum gravity and charge always has a charged particle that has a bigger charge than the mass, which is not obvious. So again, if you want, I deleted the options, but if you want the instability option to always save you, then you need to know something deep also about quantum gravity. Okay. All right. Of course, I should also note that these instabilities, you can kill the instability with a large magnetic field.
Couldn't it just be that any quantum gravity that has a connection to a real quantum field theory satisfies this?
We would think of that as being any consistent theory of quantum gravity. So the idea is that any consistent theory of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space should have a field theory dual. So, yeah. At least some people believe that. Okay, cool. Now, also, I should say you can kill this instability with a large magnetic by adding magnetic field, as usual for superconducting instabilities. Okay. So, if as well as an electric charge, you give the original black hole, you give it a magnetic charge also. That if this magnetic charge is big enough, it'll always suppress this instability. So you'd still be left with the entropy. So it's not going to save you anyway. Okay, so now let me just entertain the last option, that these states, that there's nothing wrong with these. And by the way, even if there is something wrong with them, that doesn't mean they're useless, because it's a bit like this phase diagram in the cuprates or in many other exotic superconductors. You know, there's some superconducting dome where things are unstable, but the physics of whatever lies underneath the dome may be important for explaining the normal states. Okay, and so instabilities are not by any means a bad thing.
I mean, taking this logic to the very end, it's not a physics. I mean, we have had this long standing headache. We believe that we have the zero temperature singularities that are massless, we find here a topological point. But there's not a single other system where you see it, because there's always some other competing instability taken off, like a support.
Right.
So when you take this logic to the end, wouldn't you say that it's impossible to find naked singularities in quantum mechanics? It always should be that this dome is hiding it.
Well, I'm saying that that question translates into an interesting quantum gravity question. Okay, so but suppose we accept these states, and then we could ask, okay, so there just is this critical spin ice, whatever it is. What would we see if we built this in a lab, or there was this system was somehow realized, or something analogous to the system was realized? What would an experimentalist see? So as far as I understand, a technique that's widely used is this R-piece. And what that does is you take your sample, you throw a photon at it, and you look at an electron that bounces off, and you measure these electrons as a function of energy and momentum. Okay. So suppose you did an R-piece experiment on these black holes. So how would you do that? Well, the dual description, well, you do it in the same way you do it with any material, but the dual description of this is that you take your black hole, take this geometry with its electric field, and you shoot a fermion into it. So you have just a ripple of a fermion, and then you see how the fermion comes back again. And from that, so this is like calculating a two-point function of the fermion. And you can do that as a function of frequency and momentum. So for this system, right, this is how you calculate the two-point function of fermions.
John?
Yes?
Can I ask a really silly question? You drew a diagram that looks like a two-point function of a photon and an electron. Why are you calculating a fermion two-point function?
No, so what you measure is how many electrons. Okay, I've got to say, I'm cheating. So the connection between this calculation and this is not as tight as you'd like it to be. But morally, this is supposed to give you a measure of how many fermions are in the system as a function of energy momentum. And that's also what this calculation did. It gives you the spectral density of some fermionic operator as a function of frequency and momentum. So this was done recently by several people, almost all of them which are in the audience, and there's a very interesting result. So this is great. So to calculate this spectral density as a function of frequency and momentum, all you have to do is solve the classical Dirac equation in this background. So it's a purely classical calculation, and quite a straightforward one to compute this two-point function.
The Bohr theory has been appeared as well.
Right, so that's right. Yes, we're going to add. If we want to do this, we have to add a Dirac field. But it's not turned on. We're just using it as a probe.
Please correct. You said before that the entropy of the black hole corresponds to the charge density. So let's say
at the electric field.
Now, how do you know that that's the density for a fermionic field?
Yeah, you don't. That's the beauty of it. You don't until you do this calculation. And in fact, you know, people have been speculating about Fermi surfaces and ADS-CFT for many years now with the view of some of these QCD applications. And my impression was the consensus was, oh, there's no way there's going to be a Fermi surface because they're bosons, and the bosons are going to carry all the charge and it's going to be energetically favorable. But only, you know, less than a year ago, did some people actually do the calculation to see, right? And it's very, another moral, right, is that string theorists, well, okay. Some people don't like fermions, right? And so nobody did this two-point function. And it's really not a hard, the techniques to do this have been around for a long time, okay? But it wasn't done until recently.
Fermion field
conspirators? Sorry, guess what? No, that's exactly.
Yes or no?
No. Just a fermionic. So the fermionic version of superradiance turns out to be a Fermi surface, which is very interesting. So it wants to become unstable, but it doesn't, basically. If you like. Okay, so they calculated this quantity by solving a Dirac equation in the bulk, and so you can plot the spectral density. And let's, how are we going to do it? So there's several ways of plotting this, but let's do it as it turns at a function of frequency. And it turns out that at a particular frequency, at a particular momentum, let's call it kf, the spectral density of the function of frequency has this huge peak at zero frequency. And when you vary the momentum away from KF, this thing opens and disperses a bit in both directions. So it behaves roughly like a Fermi surface. Except that you can actually calculate, you know, you can calculate this more exactly. Okay, you don't just get the peak, you get the whole dispersion. And what you find, well, okay, you can find a whole zoo of things, but let me just maybe, one interesting example is that you find a dispersion relation that looks a little bit like this. So I should say, I mean, people have worked on this have been Sunsik and Yan Zanin and John McGreevy and Hong Liu. And in particular, Hong gave a talk last week where he showed this dispersion relation. Right, so you get this. You get many things, but this is one thing that you can get, where A, B, and C are numbers, and A and B are real numbers. And the amusing thing about this is that you can find, so this is an output, okay? You do a calculation in the black hole of this spectral, this two-point function as a function of frequency in K, you solve this classical wave equation. For a certain charge and mass, this is what you get. Now, where you might have seen this before, I mean, I hadn't, of course, but so in 1989, there's a paper where people introduced so-called the marginal Fermi surface, or I think that's what they call it. Marginal Fermi liquid, which apparently was used to explain various features of the optimally dealt state of the Coupe rates. Okay, but if I understand, in that paper, it's just proposed as a phenological model, and this is a concrete realization where you can calculate this thing. Again,
you see the super radiance in fact becomes Fermi surface here.
Yeah.
So there is a particle antiparticle asymmetry.
Okay, I guess I can take 2 minutes just to roughly explain, tell you what happens. So suppose you're looking at the Green's function in frequency space, the retarded Green's function, and instability is if there's a pole in the upper half plane. Okay. Now, suppose you take one of these a boson, okay, and you might find with a big charge, you're going to find it's unstable. You could stabilize it by adding some momentum. So at large momentum, there's going to be a pole down here in the lower half plane. And then as you decrease the momentum, at some point, there's some critical momentum where this pole goes into the upper half plane and it becomes unstable. So what happens to charged fermions is that as you decrease the momentum, just when you think it's about to become unstable, it actually bounces back down and goes back down into the lower half plane. And so this is a sense in which they're similar and they're different. So they're both characterized by this pole moving up and hitting the real axis, which sort of wants to become unstable. But then by some magic, the fermion turns around and goes back down.
The K at which it bounces is KF?
Yes, yes.
And what determines KF?
So that is not a universal quantity. It depends on the specific theory. So it depends in the bulk. It depends on the charge and the mass of the fermion.
So the bound state of the charge.
Okay.
But somehow you end up with more particles than antiparticles in that language because you have a Fermi surface.
That's not new. There's a Fermi.
Yeah, but there's a net charge density.
There's a charge. Yeah. The electric field that breaks the particles and it's longer.
Well, there's a potential charge. Sorry about that. Thank you.
So, okay, that's all I really want to say. So, just let me summarize. Okay.
Maybe a comment. So, there are certain models like the one Sunksik described.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Green's functions like the one on Newfoam.
Yes.
But those condensed matter models don't have finite entropy. So, I don't quite see a connection.
Oh, no. Sure. Sorry. Let me. I wasn't saying that. I was just saying that. We have to accept the state and work with it and see what we find. Yeah.
John, are you saying that all the entropy comes from the fermion?
No. I think it's I would encourage everybody to find out what the entropy is. I mean, yeah, we don't know. There's this.
But how does it resolve the issue?
No, it doesn't resolve it. I'm just saying, I haven't said we've understood this state. I'm saying one property it has is this Fermi surface.
I guess the hope is that you'll be able to solve the entropy problem but not ruin all these features. And that's of course the key question.
So just let me summarize what I've been saying.
What is the connection between the entropy problem and the
But I'm saying that if you want to get this structure out of string theory at the moment, you need to work with a theory that has a finite entropy.
Is it really possible you can't put a neutron star model at the bottom of the electric field that would do the same thing?
It might.
As you say, neutron and black holes are not the only things that exhibit super radiance. So do rapidly or highly charged neutron stars or some such thing.
Yeah, right. No, I think there are lots of things. Look, this paper is not even out yet. Okay, so. interesting things actually, but it's not settled yet.
Okay.
Right. So, no. So, I mean, so Fermi surfaces do very interesting things in magnetic fields. For example, there is the Hausmann alpha oscillations, and you might want.
We have some results in Lyon. It looks like perfect lambda compensation. That is Lyon lattice, and it seems to be able to
come off. Well,
as it should.
Colin is going to talk about it.
Yeah, on Wednesday. Okay. No, I'm talking on Wednesday. Well, okay. All right. Okay. Very good. So let me just recap. So I won't write it down. So there's likely no unique description of string theory, but using this multiplicity of definitions of string theory, we can actually do useful things by mapping between the different descriptions. And some descriptions of string theory seem to involve strongly interacting field theories, which are objects we'd like to understand anyway. And so I've been advocating a duality perspective on strongly coupled field theory. That if we want to describe matter at finite density in these field theories, we need to use black holes. Okay, at least that's what people have done so far. But these black holes can naturally have superconducting instabilities, as much matter does. Okay, but it's not clear whether they always have them or not. And in particular, the normal state, if you ignore any superconducting instability, seems to have non-trivial Fermi surface-like behavior. And so I think it's fair to say that string theory definitely has a rich condensed matter phenomenology. And now the next step is obviously to see if that actually connects with anything in the real world. Okay, thanks.
Questions only from the other community.
That is just right here. Do you want
to put it through them?
You're not a problem.
I'm going to go away, start from a weakly interacting field theory that we know something about.
So the way it normally works is that weakly interacting field theories are dual to gravity in a very quantum regime, not in the classical regime. And so you might hope to learn something about strong quantum gravity using weakly coupled field theories. And people have tried to do that. But it's difficult.
I have a related question. If you just take a non-interacting, which basically has a power of 2, that would be strongly quantum gravity, I presume.
That's right, yes.
You know what kind?
What kind? Yes, I mean, so in these well-controlled examples, like this n equals 4 to be string theory example, we know exactly that it's some limit of string theory where the geometry is very strongly curved. The questions you'd really like to answer, that's not very useful. So the questions that we'd like to be useful is you'd like to start with a weakly curved geometry and then follow some property as the curvature becomes large and see what happens to it. So, for example, black hole singularities are something that happen in classical gravity, and you'd like to follow those into a quantum regime and see what happens to them. And the problem is not the two endpoints, but actually connecting them, because there's this, obviously, when there's a strong weak coupling duality, there's this bit in the middle that...
Could I ask very quick next question? I also see another holography in your presentation, which is I could look at your results here potentially as a damning statement about that kind of quantum critical point, because quantum critical behavior, because it would tell me that some underlying condensed matter theory would have finite entropy.
So I don't exaggerate this entropy thing too much, because it may well go away in the near future via either, say, these two mechanisms I described. I only mentioned that it is as an illustration of you can get statements that whichever way they point both directions. They point to interesting questions in condensed matter, but also to some interesting black hole physics. That was more the point I was trying to make, not that it's some big barrier.
Let me comment on one of the mechanisms for non-Fermi liquid behavior that we think we understand usually goes under the name of the Bolognese instability, by which the Fermi surface spontaneously starts and you break rotation invariance. In this language, it's hard to understand how that would happen, because you have general covariance in the bulk.
No, but you can break that. So you can certainly get inhomogeneous phases in principle.
But at the critical point,
yes.
You don't break the symmetry.
But you almost do.
So it may be that the critical state could still have a.
But in this language, you would mean that there is a question of boundary conditions frequency as opposed to bursts.
No, no. So you can definitely have spontaneous breaking of translation invariance, for example.
It's not translation invariance, I think.
The symmetry is spontaneous. Right, but you can spontaneously break any of the symmetries of the theory. These states are often harder to discuss because they have less symmetries, and that's why people spend less time discussing them. But in principle, there could be instabilities to all kinds of things. Yeah.
I feel doubly qualified. I'm neither a condensed matter theorist nor a string theorist. I hope this isn't a terribly stupid question, but you talk about duality and so on and so forth. If I take the duality that I know in condensed matter, everybody, you can talk about superconducting insulated transition terms of vortices or charge or some models. Here's my question, sort of put slightly metaphorically. I have eyes that can look at charge. Experiment. I can look at the vortices. Is there any analog here where I can look and see the strings? Is there some way to do that? Even in a condensed matter system?
Yeah, so, well...
Not naive, childlike question.
No, this is clearest in the QCD context, where if you have confinements, you literally have flux tubes, like as David said, between the mesons. So, yeah, you can sometimes. That's right. Yeah. I'm not sure about in these condensed matter analogs so much.
But just a comment. I mean, it's just always seemed intuitively to me that in the Cooperites and these strongly correlated systems, we're just looking at the wrong stuff.
That's right. I should say
that's a challenge to the experimentalist. I mean, I accept that. I have not met it, but.
No, I think it's fair to say that this duality this description is a little more abstractly related to what you see than in these cases of vortices and particles, unfortunately.
But these are limits where string tensions are sort of infinite, and so for generic models, don't you have things like redshift ropes and stringy excitation coming up? That should have some.
Yeah. That's right. I think you could yes, in a confining background.
Very simple one. So is this model with Fermi surface special for 2 plus 1, or you can...
No. No, it's not.
B plus 1.
I think it's not. No.
I'd like to know how large the class of models is for which this works. Suppose I have my favorite condensed matter system. Can I just walk to my friend, the string theorist, and ask him what is the...
Right.
I have to rely on luck that it works for a certain very small set of systems.
So I think it's fair to say that it's unlikely to work for any of your favorite systems. And in fact, it's an open question what the precise characterization of systems that have classical gravity duals are. It's not known, although people are working hard on it, including Joe and Joao and others here. The hope is that some systems that you're interested in are sufficiently similar to these systems that it's useful. But, yeah.
Okay, this program, we're now just having a discussion within the program, which is going on for another 2 weeks. So I suggest that some of this we could do during the program. Unless there are people outside the program for whom this is really getting in.
I spoke about a superconducting condensed matter problem. What if I wanted a spin density wave or a ferromagnetic condensed matter problem?
I think that's not impossible. I mean, so generically, good. So here I had some scalar field that condensed, and so that's like a sort of S-wave superconductor conducting order parameter. You could definitely try to construct more interesting order parameter and phase transitions between them. Yeah. Yeah, antiferromagnetism is a bit hard. I'm not sure how to do that. There's, for example, you could have an SU2 field in the bulk, and then that could condense, and you could get a ferromagnetic phase.
Can I follow up on that? So, I mean, if you literally take a condensed matter system with antiferromagnetism, charge density waves, and so on, or Fermi-Rankine instabilities, it may be very hard to reproduce that in string theory. But we can often derive effective low-energy field theories in certain phases or certain regimes by condensed matter methods, which look like things that might be realized. For example, a vector field representing the antifilament and the order parameter coupled in certain ways to fermions. That effective theory may be more amenable to the connection rather than the underlying lattice model.
But in all cases, you always need a field theory that has a large number of units.
Yes.
That comes
right. Okay.
That's in the nature of the beast.
What does the sigma of omega look like in this phase?
For which operator? For the fermion?
What? It's conductivity.
Oh, sigma. Sorry, I thought you meant capital sigma. Sorry.
Conductivity.
Yeah, that's good. So, in the I happen to know the 2+1 dimensional case. Okay. So in which in the normal phase. Right? So. And actually, it just does that. Which so this is exactly the. It looks like graphene, actually. So it goes to 1 because you're in 2+1 dimension, so the conductivity is dimensionless. So at large frequencies, it goes to a constant, and then at the order of the chemical potential, it goes down. The k dependence is not being worked out.
I don't care about the k dependence, but this has a finite density, so why isn't there a conductivity at low frequency?
Good. So this is a very. I'm going to talk about this a bit on Wednesday as well. It's a complicated question. I see the connection between the conductivity and this stuff is obscured by this large n limit that we take, and I think that we have to work. To go beyond that, to actually understand what's happening.
There are coming more degrees of freedom contributing to conductivity.
That's right. So somehow, this is not isolated the contribution from these,
there's particles. Bosons around.
Zero at zero frequency?
No, it's not. I think it's some. It's some fine. I think there's some finite number there. It really, it looks, the experimental plots of graphene look exactly like this. By which I mean?
Spectral functions, height of C and the conductivity of graphene. That kind of covers it all. So,
no, but what?
Specifically, it is very firm.
Well, I want to say, I think it's actually an important question that we need to isolate the contribution of these quasi-particles to the conductivity, and it's not been done yet.
Okay. I mean, you know, one question that whether or not this applies to the materials that have marginal Fermi liquid, there's a statement that was the statement made by the people that proposed this phenomenology, that once I give you this, that everything else that you see in the cuprates follows.
Right, exactly.
So in particular, if the conductivity looks like this, then there can't be a logical connection between that and what you see in the cuprates.
No. There's just more stuff knocking around.
More stuff wrong. I guess the contribution of that part of Fermi surface has not been calculated yet. That requires a higher order calculation.
Yeah.
This does not represent the contribution from the domains.
So this actually knows more about some underlying Dirac fermions.
Well, I think this is almost probably completely fixed by relativistic invariance, which is why it's the same as graphene, I suspect.
Okay, you're talking on this on Wednesday?
Yeah.
One question.